Good evening. I'm Paul Wilkins, the Deputy University Librarian here and the Secretary of the Friends of the University of Adelaide Library. A warm welcome to the Bar Smith and to this University of Adelaide Friends of the Library event, which I know many people have been looking forward to with great anticipation. I've got two apologies. One is from Ray Choate, the University Librarian, who is most unfortunately on sick leave today. Secondly, from our new Friends President, Professor Christopher Burrell. He is, of course, juggling a number of commitments to transition into this role and just had an unavoidable conflict tonight, so he sends his apologies. There's an apology of another kind I'd like to give, which is probably some of you are feeling a bit warm in here. We apologise for that. We're doing our best. We'll keep the doors open, but you might want to shed your winter coats. A little housekeeping item standard at these events is please turn off or silence your mobile phones. I think that's all the preliminaries. So I'd like to ask our treasurer, actually, Dr. Jane Walkley, to introduce our speaker tonight, Dee Nolan.
I had the pleasure last year of hearing Dee speak. She's an inspiration. I wonder if any of you who might have seen her book already and know something about the Camino, because tonight is going to be a very special night. I would like to say that Dee is busy in walking and talking to people along the way of the Camino de Santiago de Compostela, and particularly interested in the food and the people and the way they produce food and as part of their culture. This modern day pilgrimage is becoming more and more popular, and I think you will find tonight that there'll be a few more people who might be interested in doing it. I would like to invite Dee to come up and talk to us. Thank you, Dee.
Jane, thank you so much for a wonderful welcome. I'm not sure how I'm going to live up to that. I hope I do give you a good sense of the pilgrimage tonight and what it's all about and why we're talking about it again. And you're here because you're already interested. And as Jane said, I think by the end of the night, hopefully, for a lot of you, that might have taken you a few steps further down the pilgrimage. How many people here tonight have actually walked some of the, or been in any way car walking on the pilgrimage to Santiago? So quite a few. I have a little short film that I'd like to start with. It was a little film that we made from the photographs from the book. I had the great good fortune to do this book with Earl Carter, who's not just one of Australia's top photographers, but really a very highly regarded international photographer. And there's a lot of books about the pilgrimage that talk about people's own, you know, experiences and but without photographs. And I know before I set off, I really had no idea what I was heading into. And so I thought I would just start with this little film so that at least you can, in your mind, have some kind of idea of where we're heading tonight. And Paul is very kindly agreed to do all the technical stuff. So you see a little taste of the landscapes, the beautiful Romanesque architecture, the food producers. It's just a tiny taste. I have a gorgeous funny friend in Sydney who says her life should be a magazine. This is because when it comes to all the more significant lifestyle trends, she is inevitably, uncannily, always ahead of the curve. When she does something, you can guarantee that a year or two later, we'll all want to be doing it. Let me give you one example. She installed hens in her backyard in Balmain, when the rest of us were still cottoning on to the concept of free-range eggs from the supermarket. But look over those fences now and you'll see city chooks happily clucking away in urban gardens from Perth to Melbourne. This friend was the first Australian I knew to do a pilgrimage to Santiago de Compostela. She did it in 1993, the year the whole thing exploded. That European summer, so many people turned up on the newly retraced pilgrim path across northern Spain that the army was called in to put up tents along the way to accommodate them all. In both instances, my friend was on the money. Our newfound relationship with the backyard chook has proved to be no passing fad. It is reconnecting us with the source of our food and perhaps in some small way reassuring us that our instincts for self-sufficiency and survival haven't been lost. In the fabulous Albert Park bookshop in Melbourne last Monday, they told me that books about chickens are in big demand. Neither is the pilgrimage to Santiago de Compostela a passing fad. The opposite, in fact. Let me give you some figures. In 1985, 2,500 pilgrims received the official certificate of completion. In 2010, 270,000 pilgrims received the certificate. So there you have it. I find it curious that when so few of us are going to church and we can buy any sort and size of egg we want in the supermarket, that we are going on pilgrimages and raising chooks. Perhaps these two phenomena say more about our state of mind right now than we realise. Perhaps my next book should be The Chook Lover's Pilgrimage to Santiago de Compostela. What is this pilgrimage to Santiago de Compostela? A map. A little bit of history first. All religions have their pilgrimages to holy places. And the absolute heyday for the Christian pilgrimage was the Middle Ages. The medieval church actively encouraged pilgrimages by granting indulgences to those who journeyed to sacred shrines containing the relics of saints and martyrs. The highest indulgence guaranteed your place in heaven. It was a serious business. Once you made your vow of pilgrimage, it could only be dissolved by a bishop. The three big pilgrimages of the Middle Ages were to Rome, Jerusalem, and Santiago de Compostela, a small city in northwest Spain, which is there. So there's Spain, France, other countries. There was a pecking order of relics. At the top was anything to do with Jesus Christ, then the Virgin Mary, and then following closely behind the apostles, and so on down the hierarchy of saints and martyrs. Santiago, of course, is Spanish for St. James, who was, of course, one of Christ's apostles, St. James the Greater. That is why the shrine in the cathedral at Santiago de Compostela is so very important, because the believers believe that this was where the body of St. James was taken after he was beheaded in Jerusalem by Herod. It is a truly Premier League relic. There are two mythologies and representations of Santiago, or St. James. The one we know best is as the kindly pilgrim, his scallop shell, the symbol of the pilgrimage, fixed to his hat. But he was also evoked by early Christians fighting the Moors in what is now northern Spain. These soldiers in the 8th century believed St. James had appeared as a warrior on a white charger, slaying thousands of Moors and so winning a critical battle. And so, in those glorious medieval Romanesque churches that you glimpsed in some of those photographs and that still stand along the pilgrim path, you are as likely to see gung-ho statues of St. James the Moor Slayer, or Matamoros in Spanish, as you are depictions of the devout and humble St. James. This particular pilgrimage was so popular in the 11th, 12th and 13th centuries that it rivaled the great pilgrimages to Rome and Jerusalem. Some say it was even bigger than the other two. Tens of thousands of pilgrimages to Santiago were made each year. I've done my own calculations and I reckon that most Europeans in the Middle Ages would have known of someone who had made the journey. It was no walk in the park, that's for sure. Pilgrims were robbed by bandits, eaten by wolves, and starved by locust plagues. Some of the most poignant moments of my time on the pilgrim path were at the little graveyards for those who never made it home. It would have taken great fortitude and courage, and of course, once they reached their destination, there was no hopping on Ryanair and being back at your desk the following Monday morning. There was the equally long and dangerous journey home. While this pilgrimage is often talked about as the earliest example of mass tourism because a monk wrote a book about it and because of the numbers of people who did it, the pious pilgrims of the Middle Ages to northern Spain had little in common, however, with the sun lovers of the 1960s to southern Spain, where, of course, the birthplace, which was, of course, the birthplace of modern mass tourism. But because of their sheer numbers in the Middle Ages, they did bring vast wealth and influence. The Camino, as the pilgrimage is also called and often really more commonly called, became as much a conduit for knowledge and education, plants and vines, commerce and art, as it was a spiritual path. Most of the medieval pilgrims were from what is now France or were from even further afield. This is because the north of the Iberian Peninsula was very sparsely populated, and so the French were given financial inducements by local nobility and the church to stay and set up businesses along the path to provide for the pilgrims' needs. The great French religious orders built monasteries and hospitals along the route as well to look after the pilgrims, and they brought with them their vast knowledge of classical literature, medicine, agriculture, and architecture. One of the loveliest surprises of my experience with the Camino has been my coup de foudre with those Romanesque buildings, still standing as magnificently in the landscape today as the day they were completed 1,000 years ago. The stories from the Bible told in exquisite carvings still there above their grand entrances and at the top of the pillars. But all good things must come to an end. Over the next 600 years, the pilgrimage dwindled in importance and relevance as religious doctrine was challenged, philosophy moved on, and wars brought constantly changing allegiances. And so you come to 1867, and that very holiest of days on the pilgrimage, the feast day of St. James on July 25, when it was recorded that only a handful of pilgrims turned up at the cathedral in Santiago de Compostela. 100 years later, nothing much had changed. I interviewed the head of the pilgrim office for my book. He recalled that when he was a young priest in the cathedral during the 1970s, there would be 70 to 80 pilgrims a year. Now, daily, the queue of pilgrims waiting to receive their certificate of completion, just beyond his office door, stretches out beyond the doors to the first floor pilgrim office, down the stairwell and along the street outside. In recent decades, it has witnessed a totally unpredicted renaissance. No one doubts that there are as many people doing the pilgrimage now as there were in its medieval heyday. Those pilgrims queuing for their certificate are just the tip of the iceberg. Many, many more people do sections of the pilgrimage without showing up in any record books. It was only when I bought a second-hand copy of James A. Michener's book, Iberia, his bestseller written in the 1960s, and read what he wrote about the pilgrimage, that it fully dawned on me that it was General Franco who had paved the way for this 20th century rebirth of the pilgrimage. Franco, of course, was proudly Galician, and Galicia is the area that Santiago is in northwest Spain. He was also a very big fan of St. James, who is the patron saint of Spain. Franco, like those Christian soldiers in the 8th century, appropriated the warrior-like representation of Santiago in one of the key battles of the 1930s Civil War. And later he would stage grand celebrations in Santiago de Compostela on St. James feast day. Critically, though, he also funded scholars who identified the early pilgrim paths. Michener travelled with many of these scholars, and his account was one of the most important and revealing in all my research, and one of the most entertaining. He was a wonderful journalist, Michener. He was a very captivating writer, and he was a great bon viveur. I really wished I could have been along for the ride. In Santiago, I was told by the locals that the great statues representing St. James as the Moor Slayer caused a few problems in these sensitive times. One of these locals took me to a side altar in the Santiago Cathedral, where there's a particularly robust example of St. James as the Moor Slayer. She pointed out how these days the gory heads of slaughtered Moors rolling away under the feet of St. James's horse are hidden behind tall, thick displays of foliage. On the day I visited, the carnage was nowhere to be seen behind a hedge of white dahlias. The city fathers fervently hope that it is a case of out of sight, out of mind. I first heard of the pilgrimage to Santiago de Compostela in the 1980s. I was working in London, where I lived for 23 years. The English, of course, are great walkers and travellers, and they were fascinated when those scholars, funded by Franco, identified one of the main medieval pilgrim paths, the Camino Francés, which is the one in yellow here. It means the way or path of the French. So think about who the first pilgrims were from France, and you have the Camino Francés. It runs 700 kilometres from the Pyrenees, which are here, and the border of which, you know, the border of France and Spain in the Pyrenean Mountains, to its final destination, the cathedral in Santiago de Compostela. Stories about it started to appear in the travel pages of the more upmarket newspapers like the Times and Telegraph, made all the more alluring by tales of the brooding and mysterious regions that are the bookends of the Camino Francés. In the east is the troubled Basque country, straddling, as I said, the Pyrenees. The pilgrims trudged across its dangerous mountains, heading west to the Celtic outpost of Galicia. In so many ways, untouched by time for centuries, isolated as it was in Spain's farthest northwest corner, and it's still like that today. I love these stories about the plucky English who set out in the 1970s and 1980s to walk the rediscovered Pilgrim Way. Of course, then, there were none of the nicely maintained paths pilgrims enjoy today, let alone the array of hostels and cafes. Whether it was a quest for authenticity or their love of dressing for the occasion, many of those first English visitors had turned up to pick their way along the old paths wearing medieval pilgrim garb. The locals who had not been reading the Times or the Telegraph were completely puzzled and astonished. I started reading more about all of this and about the cult of relics that was at the heart of the medieval pilgrimage. I saw how the pilgrim path seemed to be determined by two things. Of course, the topography of the land and the desire to visit those places where there were shrines containing those relics of saints and martyrs. And so the first pilgrims had walked in the footsteps of the Romans and who knows who else before them, going back in history, because the pilgrim paths went where it was the most natural place to go in the landscape. skirting difficult terrain and maximizing places of ready access. You still walk on Roman roads today for part of it. But then there would be a diversion that didn't make sense, until you learned that it was to a place where relics existed, where the pilgrims would go seeking help and cures from the holy dead and an intercession to get to heaven in the afterlife. This pilgrimage became a beep on my radar that over 25 years beeped louder and louder. I met more and more people who'd done sections of it, and then my husband John visited Santiago de Compostela and brought me back a scallop shell. But still it was a couple of years after I had returned home to live in Australia before I stepped onto the path. The catalyst, like so much in life, was a chance conversation. It was with a publisher from Penguin on a hot summer's day in Sydney. From out of nowhere, the pilgrimage to Santiago came up. And I told her I was utterly fascinated by it. It turned out she was too. And so the idea for the book was born and my research began. My book became a 4-year project that combined my two greatest areas of interest, food and history. They are natural partners, especially in Europe, where food has a background, a story. It is culturally linked. The pilgrim paths wind their way through the farms and vineyards, as well as passing by some of the most outstanding medieval architecture ever built. Food and history. I knew from the start that I could not write about one without having an understanding of the other. After all, a food culture is as much a result of wars, trade, migration, and occupation as it is about terroir, the soil, and the climate in which it is grown. I grew up on a farm here in South Australia near Narracourt, and after a long career in journalism in Europe and the US, I once again live on that farm. Rural life is part of my DNA, along with a deep respect for the work of farmers, providing us, as they do, with our most basic human requirement, the food we eat every day. I guess I inherited from my father that typical farmer's habit of looking over other farmers' fences and wondering why they've planted that particular crop or bought that breed of ram. That's what I do, I'm afraid, when I travel wherever I am. The minute I'm out in the countryside, I'm kind of looking over those fences. So I wanted to experience the pilgrimage and reach over the fence and chat to the farmer. I wanted to gain some sort of understanding of what I was seeing every day, of the life being lived today in the places I was passing through, and of what had gone before. As you walk the pilgrim paths, there is a deep sense of walking in the steps of those who have gone before you. With a 1,000-year stretch between the original medieval pilgrimage and its modern-day renaissance, I had plenty of work to do. I made 2 extended visits to France and Spain, travelling along the pilgrimage and meeting the cooks and producers whose stories I would tell in the book. The main pilgrim way across northern Spain, as I already mentioned, starts in, it may be the troubled Basque country in many ways, but it is also heaven on earth for a food lover. The path then weaves its way west through a succession of glorious cuisines to Galicia, which is the seafood paradise of not just Spain, but possibly Europe. In corny modern marketing jargon, it could just as well be a gastronomic produce trail. Not forgetting, of course, the wines of Rioja and those other wines from grapes grown in rediscovered ancient vineyards stretching back to Roman times. This is green Spain, where much of the country's finest produce comes from, the vegetables, the grain, the mountain cheeses, and the exceptional seafood. Alongside the excitement of the new wave of Spanish cooking that started in San Sebastian is a renewed respect for traditional ingredient-based cuisine, whether you are eating a 7-euro menu of the day in Santiago or in somewhere multi-Michelin starred. I really, really loved walking through northern Spain in spring. My Australian eyes are used to less forgiving rural landscapes, So the lush pasture and wild herbs growing knee-high beside the path were a constant joy and kind of surprise for me. You share the path, as you saw in the photos, with farmers moving their sheep from one field to another or bringing their cows in for milking. It's truly magical. As a farmer, it was reassuring to see that much of rural life in northern Spain continues at a recognisable human level. It is a timely reminder, I think, of what we stand to lose if we let the big corporations produce our food behind the locked doors of industrial sheds. In Australia, we may not have the centuries-old food traditions of France and Spain, but there's a sense of urgency, a feeling of, I don't know, just in time, that unites those in the old world and the new world who care about how our food is produced. Just as here, people like Saskia Beer are newly treasuring our old breeds of pigs like the Berkshires, I visited a man called Pierre Oteiza in the French Basque country and saw his Basque pigs, a breed he had rescued when there were just 20 left. These pigs had fallen foul of the 1970s lean meat police. And just in time, we remembered that fat equals flavour. There are now more than 3,000 black Basque pigs who are living a shortish but happy life, foraging in the oak woods of the Pyrenees. Across the border in the Spanish Basque region, I had one of the best meals of my life in a restaurant where everything is cooked over fire and different ingredients are matched with coals made from different woods, oak, orange, apple, vine clippings. The chef was a woodsman from the village who taught himself to cook. His father grows the vegetables. The success of the restaurant, now regularly named as one of the top 50 in the world, is a triumph of common sense, for their food was a lesson in simplicity, superb raw ingredients, touched lightly and respectfully in the kitchen, and left to speak for themselves. In a remote mountain region, we drank wine from long-forgotten grape varieties from heritage vines, and understood why wine lovers are bowled over by their originality and elegance. These vines were so nearly ripped out to make way for Cabernet Sauvignon and Merlot, grape varieties grown everywhere in the world. Some of the vines were hundreds of years old, and they were in vineyards found and restored by the most inspiring young Spanish winemaker, who has had to learn to use horses and donkeys to work the ground because it is too steep for tractors, which is why they weren't ripped out. In Rioja, we ate another sensational meal at a hotel where the chef's family had run for 400 years before him. He shares the kitchen with his mother, who is the complete godmother of traditional Riojan cuisine. Out one door of the kitchen goes robust food for her restaurant. Out the other door goes her son's delicate new wave interpretation of the local cuisine and ingredients. And so in one kitchen, food traditions evolve with new generations, preserving their provenance while acknowledging that we need less calories in our less physical lives. We had seconds and thirds of pork chops and homemade cheeses in a farmhouse bed and breakfast where all the food came from the little farm. We left with a precious jar of their honey, which absolutely delighted the top chef in Santiago de Compostela when we gave it to him, because he buys as much of the produce as he can for his fine restaurant from the women in the farmers market. We sheltered from the rain in a cafe on the pilgrim path and watched the cook dash out to the garden to get the lettuces for lunch. Soon after, we sodden pilgrims broke into applause when the baker arrived with more supplies of the chewy, crusty bread we love so much in Galicia. It was still warm. The pilgrimage really is an all-embracing term for the many thousands of kilometres of those paths in France and Spain and beyond that all lead to Santiago de Compostela, which is why I leave the map up, because you can see that these are all paths that have been identified And so it's really like a motorway map of Europe. Of course, the medieval pilgrims' path started from their front door. Well, it started from the church, where there was always a mass for them, and the priest would walk them to the end of the village, and then they would head off on their pilgrimage. But you can see that the path in yellow that we identified before, the Camino Frances, going across northern Spain, is really the main path, and I'll just talk about that in a minute, which something like 70% of all people who experience their pilgrimage walk on that path. But coming down through France, you have, and this is all about topography, again, how these paths kind of emerged as main routes, if you like. You have four paths that come down through France to join up with the Camino Frances. You have a path from Paris, you have a path from Vézelay, you have a path from Le Puy, and you have a path from Arles. And so all these other little paths join up with those, and you'll always find that there's, as I mentioned before, kind of churches and reasons and shrines and relics why they do that. What sections you do and how you travel depends on what you're interested in and how you like to travel. But I wanted my book to be able to help and inspire anyone interested to be able to make those decisions. It's a truly, truly, truly rewarding thing to do. But how you do it is up to you. The best advice I got about my pilgrimage was given to me by a woman called Nancy Frey in Santiago. Nancy is an American who went to Spain in 1993, the year of the explosion. She went there to research the Camino for her PhD back home in California, but she never went home. There can't be too many people who've travelled the French Way across the top of Spain as many times as Nancy and her husband Jose. She has also worked as a volunteer in refugios and spent time with thousands of pilgrims in the past two decades. She now takes small groups on the pilgrim path, and I went with her. She said to me when we met, "What you must do is your Camino, your way. Be true to your interests," she said. "Be true to the way you like to travel and true to the reason why you wanted to do the pilgrimage in the first place." This is what I did, and that is the advice I pass on now if someone asks me. All up, I've now probably travelled somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 kilometres along pilgrim paths in France and Spain by car. I haven't walked 3,000 or 4,000 kilometres. I've walked 250 kilometres of that northern Spanish section, the Camino Frances. I've travelled along the rest of it, but I haven't walked the whole thing. Last September, I walked another truly beautiful 200-kilometre section in central France from Le Puy, where I know Jane was as well. And a few months ago, I spent several weeks on and off more paths in France. I also spent two precious days retracing my steps a few weeks ago on the Camino between Logroño and Burgos in northern Spain. And I felt this overwhelming whoosh of emotion and a great sense of homecoming as I arrived back there. The pilgrimage does that to you. If it's a long contemplative walk you want to do, then the pilgrimage to Santiago de Compostela follows some of the most beautiful walking paths in Europe and gives you plenty of opportunity for reflection. Or if you want to spend time on the pilgrim paths, walking or perhaps cycling, as well as taking time to experience the great historical and food cultures along the way, then it's easy to plan your journey so you can enjoy both. I do often say that you shouldn't be afraid to linger for a few days if there's something that takes your fancy, or somewhere that takes your fancy, or someone who takes your fancy, or to take a taxi off the pilgrim path to see something new. But then if driving is what you enjoy, then the pilgrimage is perfectly accessible by car. And And in fact, in the 60s, as a result of Franco's work, it was heavily promoted in Spain as a driving holiday. I like to talk about the different ways of doing the pilgrimage because if the Camino is ultimately about a generosity of spirit and opening our minds, then there must be a welcome for everyone, room for the individual to experience it in a way that means most to them and that they are physically able to do. There is no doubt it is one of the great travel experiences on this planet. Nancy Frey told me right at the start that it leaves few people unmoved, and so it has been with me. Being on the pilgrimage also unites us in a common purpose, whatever our age or status back home. Hardly a day passes when I don't think about it. I miss the freedom and the calm I felt on the Camino. I miss the sense of belonging to a larger community of pilgrims stretching back 1,000 years. I miss the greetings of farmers as we pass them in their fields. I miss having food and wine so strongly connected to the region where it is grown, food that is part of cultural traditions passed from generation to generation. Mine is certainly not the first book to be written about the pilgrimage. It has inspired some fine writing, much of which has in turn inspired and informed me, for which I'm very grateful. I mentioned the James Michener book before, which was a particular find for me. But what I really wanted to know for my book was how should an Australian who loves food and history experience this pilgrimage? Unlike our fellow European pilgrims, we cannot be striding out on a pilgrim path within a couple of hours of leaving home. Most of us here approach it differently, thinking that if we're going all that way, then we must make the most of it. Who knows when we might have the opportunity to return? It also greatly fascinated me that at a time when our churches are emptying, so many people are finding a modern meaning in this 1,000-year-old Christian ritual. As I've mentioned, I'm happy to bet that we are witnessing the greatest numbers of pilgrims on the way of St. James since the Middle Ages. We're as sure as we can be about why medieval man set out to pray to St. James's relics in Santiago. A deep fear of going to hell was a very powerful motivator. But in the 20th and 21st centuries, a time notable, as I've said, for the decline in organized religion in the Western world, why are we so interested in this pilgrimage? I spent a long time talking with a very eloquent and wise man who runs the pilgrim office at St. John Pied de Port. The name of this small French Basque town translates, and it is there, translates as St. John at the foot of the pass, meaning the pass through the Pyrenees. As I said, it is where 70% of modern pilgrims start their journey. I asked this man, with all his daily contact with pilgrims, why he thought the pilgrimage was back. "We are suffering from an overdose of modernity," he said. I think a lot about that phrase. I think we have a sense of what he's talking about. It's an unease, hard to put your finger on, that can leave us feeling curiously unfulfilled despite all the progress of the past half century. I find it curious and not unrelated that a whole academic discipline has grown up around the notion of happiness. This is what their research, which I'm pretty fascinated by, tells us. That the more successful we are, the greater the likelihood that we will feel unhappy. That spending money on experiences brings longer lasting happiness than just buying yet more stuff. That we judge our self-worth by a jam-packed diary and bestow virtue on the length of our to-do lists. That focusing on our bodies at the expense of our hearts and minds is leaving us unhappy and pessimistic. Of course, if we all just stopped for a bit and thought about it, we'd come to the same conclusions as all those clever folk at Harvard who study this stuff and the Institute of this and that. But most of us don't because we can't afford the time. And so we continue on the consumer treadmill, trapped in our chronic busyness while our spiritual life ebbs away. So what to do about it? There is a wonderful Latin proverb which may be familiar to some of you. Solvitur ambulando. It means it is solved by walking. A doctor friend and a fellow pilgrim explained that all our senses work best when we are walking because it is the most natural state for our bodies. So it rewards us with a heightened sense of what we see and hear and smell as we move through the landscape. So I really would urge you to experience at least some of the pilgrim path on foot. Because walking soothes and calms. It is a real antidote to that overdose of modernity that we have created. In the simple act of walking, I discovered that some level of spirituality will find you, even if you haven't set out in search of it. Because it limits what we carry, so walking simplifies our choices, which can be a welcome relief in these times overburdened with choice. With fewer possessions comes greater freedom, less distractions, fewer decisions to make in a day, freeing up room on the chip for thinking time, or just time to just be. There has been much said by philosophers and thinkers about the benefits of walking, but probably something that really resonates with me was written by the writer Hilaire Belloc early last century. In an essay on pilgrimage, he said, "The volume and depth and intensity of the world is something that only those on foot will ever experience." Well, you know, you can't wholly agree that a proper appreciation of the world around us is only available to those on foot. But my own revelation has been that it certainly increases it beyond all measure. So is it really such a surprise then that this pilgrimage is providing such a pleasing antidote to our overdose of modernity? I'll finish with a little word of warning. My interest in this pilgrimage was slow burn, building slowly over several decades. But for some people, it lands like a meteor from outer space. One minute they've never heard of it, the next minute they're on a plane. This happened to friends of mine, a couple from Sydney in their late 50s. They met someone at a party who told them how he had walked the pilgrim path across northern Spain. My friends definitely weren't walkers, but within weeks they had booked their tickets to St. John Pied de Port and were in outdoor shops buying their first ever backpacks. They walked every one of those 700 kilometres to Santiago, staying in hostels with 100-bed dormitories and 2 toilets. They both say it was one of the great golden times of their 30 years together. One of my favourite Camino books is an absolutely charming account called On Foot to the End of the World. It was written by an Austrian travel writer, René Freund, about his walk from Le Puy in central France to Santiago, which he did in the late 1990s. Like the couple from Sydney, he knew nothing about it before he went to a friend's wedding, where he got talking to a many times pilgrim. Within weeks, he and his wife were on the path. In the book, he never really works out why he's doing it, but that ceases to matter. You've been warned. Thank you very much. I'm very, very happy to answer questions if I can, if you've got some.
From a devout Catholic from another country, did you meet any people doing it for religious purposes?
So how did you know I was devout? Yes, absolutely. It is most of the people, my researchers and my own observations and experience tell me that most people doing the pilgrimage are not doing it for religious reasons in the sense of organized religious reasons. But when I say most, you know, that's sort of more than 50%. There are still a lot of people who do the pilgrimage for deeply religious, church religious regions, organized religion, religious regions, if you get my drift. Because you can also be deeply religious without belonging to or adhering to organized religious churches, etc. You do see a lot of Spaniards in particular. You'll see, you go into little churches, you'll see that they pamphlets about pilgrimage tours to Santiago or to churches along the way. The children in Spain do it as well. It's great. The kids in Spain, at some part of their schooling, all of them go on the pilgrimage. But yes, in answer to your question, you still see a lot of people doing the pilgrimage for religious reasons. I think one of the great joys of it, though, is that it is an ecumenical experience. And that is you know, it would welcome people from whatever religion doing it for religious reasons, because it is the opportunity for contemplation. You cannot not go into those beautiful Romanesque churches without feeling moved somehow by how they came about and the very beauty of the space and the churches themselves. You also cannot go to the Pilgrim Mass at 12 o'clock in Santiago de Compostela every day without being hugely moved. The first time I went to that, and that's the Mass at which most pilgrims will try to get to that Mass. It is the culmination of their whole pilgrimage. It's at noon. How to explain it? You know, there is just such an overwhelming feeling of spirituality in that Mass, isn't there? There was a couple of photos actually in the little sort of thing I showed you earlier people just are so moved by that Mass. Oh, look, it's the same heartbreaking thing is happening here. Yes, you do, but, you know, in Australia, I think the average age of farmers is 57, and I think it's exactly the same, you know, in Europe as well. And so it's the same thing in the villages. It's the older people, you know, who are out in their vegetable gardens. I mean, there were wonderful moments when, you know, a whole family would be there. But, of course, when you're walking during the day, a lot of the kids are at school, so you don't necessarily see that younger side of life. But, yeah, no, they have the same problem as we do, which is how to make farming an attractive thing for a younger person to do.
I believe a lot of the refugios are often full. Can you camp along the way in a tent?
You can. You can take your own tent, or you can take your swag if you like and just kind of sleep outdoors if you want to. There is times of the year when it's better to obviously be on the pilgrimage than others. So really June, July, August. When did you do it, Jane? Yes. Too cold to camp. But did you have problems finding accommodation? Yeah. Once the weather warms up, and it does get very, very hot, you know, as Australians sometimes we forget that in Europe it can be, you know, hotter than it is here. And that northern Spain climate is a very hot summer climate. But, of course, in June, July, August, and especially July and August, that's when all the kind of uni students go and people who can, you know, that's when they take their annual holidays. So it is jam-packed then. And so, yes, you would have difficulty. It's not impossible, but you would have difficulty finding somewhere to stay. You can sort of phone ahead. Depends what level of accommodation. If you're going to do the refugios and the hostels operate on a first come first serve basis. They don't open their doors till midday normally. Three, yeah. Because there was a phenomenon a few years ago when a German comedian wrote a book about the pilgrimage, which sold millions of copies in Germany. And, you know, suddenly, bang, you know, every second German was on the pilgrim path. And you know how I think they were getting the first beds, let's just say they were getting the first beds. You could free camp, as there's nothing to stop you bedding down on the path. But don't know, Jane, we wouldn't. Seriously recommend it.
Sites sort of spring up.
Yeah.
It's very advisable to ask permission of the person who's landed in the
library. Yes, just because a lot of European farms aren't fenced like ours doesn't mean that farmers necessarily want people sleeping all over it.
I was there in 71, so.
Oh, really? Right, okay, on the Camino del Norte, the, yeah.
And ate the oranges out of the grape, the farmer's food.
I don't want to put you off by saying that there's a lot of people. I mean, it's a very big country. There's, you know, you can see how many thousands of kilometres of pilgrim paths there are. And so I gave those numbers as a way of really just illustrating how this Camino has really struck a core with so many people. But really only in those summer months would you feel that it was really overcrowded. You know, you really want to go in, like Jane did, March, April. I went in May. I've always been in either May or September.
Is it really a transforming experience? You talk about the overwhelming spiritual experience of having Mass, taking Mass at Santiago de Compostela. If you hadn't actually walked any part of the Camino, would you still have that experience? Or is it a combination of the interaction with other pilgrims, your meditation, and that's the focal point of the journey?
I don't know if you all heard the question. The question was about whether, if you haven't walked or, you know, journeyed on the pilgrim path, would you still feel that level of spirituality? Well, I can tell you the first time I went to Mass, to the pilgrim Mass in Santiago de Compostela, I hadn't set foot on the path. And I sat in that Mass, and I find it really hard to tell this story without crying again, but I sat in that Mass and, you know, it was immensely moving. In front of me was a group of young people, and they were taking photos of each other. It was the end of their pilgrimage. And then they waved to somebody at the back of the cathedral coming in, and I turned around, and walking down the aisle were a couple who were in their, probably their early 70s. And they were saying, "Oh, you made it, you made it." This couple came in and sat in front of me. They kind of pushed their backpacks off. And he just put his hand out and held her hand. Here I go. And he just said to her, "We did it." Now, John, my husband, is sitting here. He knows. I walked out of it. Was I just cried and cried, and everybody else was so pleased for them. You had no idea what the backstory was, but you just knew from what you saw that all these young people were so pleased for this couple and proud of them. And I walked out, and I made one of those expensive Telstra mobile phone calls home to John, and I said, "I have got to do this pilgrimage."
Thank you, Dee. I think we'll have to finish there. I told you she was inspirational, didn't I? Thank you very much, Dee. It's just, that's exactly what I thought too, that you have to experience your own pilgrimage, your own Camino, and for especially the people, especially the wonderful landscapes, and especially the food. I would say if you buy the book, and I recommend the book, relive Dee's pilgrimage every day. I think we will all also look forward to the next one. I'd like to thank you very much for coming, Dee.